Again with me, Kirsty Young. Listen on BBC Sounds.
This is Radio 3. It's midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Brian Cox has enjoyed a prolific career in theatre, film and television over the last 60 years, working with the most esteemed theatre companies and renowned Hollywood directors. He was born in Dundee and became obsessed by film from an early age. After seeing Albert Finney in Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, he decided he too could make a go of it. Over the years, he's never been afraid to take on difficult, unlikable characters, including Hannibal Lecter in Manhunter, Hermann Göring in Nuremberg, and most recently, the terrifying media tycoon and patriarch Logan Roy in the TV series Succession, for which he won a Golden Globe. On stage, he's played King Lear at the National Theatre and won an Olivier Award as Titus Andronicus. He's currently appearing as Johann Sebastian Bach in a play called The Score. We've come to some rehearsal rooms to meet him. Brian, we're going to hear music by Bach, Mahler and Puccini, but first, some Verdi. Why this?
When I was a kid, a fellow who was at the school before me, he was leaving, and his job suddenly became available at Dundee Rep. So the teacher, a guy called Bill Dewar, and who kind of looked after me, he just said, look, why don't you go up for this job? And I thought, oh, I was 15. So I said, OK, and my education had been a disaster up to then. So I went along to the Rep. I went in the front door, and of course, the Dundonian accent is a very strong accent. And the woman at the bar, she says, what do you want, son? And I said, I'm here for an interview with Mr. Henderson, the theatre. Ah, then, oh, son, you can't get in here. You can't get to the front, pay the front. You've got to go to the back to get to the front. If you go to the back, you can come to the front, but you can't get to the front from the front. You've got to go to the back to get to the front. And I thought, once I understood what that was, I said, fine. So I went around the back of the theatre, and I entered, and there were two people having a huge row, almost physical row. And one of them was the actor, Nicol Williamson, who was the first actor I ever saw, really. So I got past that, and then I got up to a floor where the guy was smoking a cigarette, an actor called Gorn Granger, and he said to me, are you all right, darling? And I thought, this is a very strange place. They're knocking, you know, they're punching one another downstairs and somebody calls me darling. So it's clearly the place that I have to be. So then I went in for my interview with John Henderson, who was delightful, and he asked me about classical music. I kind of froze for a second. I thought, let me think. And then I realised that I didn't know any classical music except there was a teacher called Brad Cato, who was our music teacher, a really good man, nice man. And he had played the trumpet march from Aida. So I sort of was bold as brass, said, well, I love Verdi. And he said, what? Verdi, I like Verdi. John Henderson looked at me and said, Verdi? I said, yes. And I love that piece. Do you know that piece in Aida, the piece that goes da, 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 da? I love that. Of course, he could see right through me that this was kind of a bluff on my part. Anyway, I got the job.
Well, that's an important piece.
So this is an important piece to me.
Thank you. Grand March from Verdi's Aida, performed by the band and the state trumpeters of the Royal Horse Guards. Tell me a little bit more about growing up in Dundee, looking out over the River Tay.
Yeah, I lived in number 19 Brown Constable Street, and it's still there, actually. And my first view was the Tay, and I remember as a wee boy looking at the Tay, and of course my immediately instinct as a wee boy's curiosity was to cross it and get away, you know. And of course subsequently I did when I went to drama school. But it was, the great thing about Dundee is its people. It's a city that's been messed around with considerably over the years, and it's now finding its feet, though it does have huge difficulty in terms of drug addiction, which is truly tragic. But that actually stems from real poverty. In fact, I did a programme recently which was called How the Other Half Live, which was looking at how things were. But of course, in the present climate, things have regressed rather than progressed.
You clearly have a very strong social conscience, which is rather interesting given that you play the most ghastly people sometimes. But your father was a grocer, wasn't
he? Yeah, I still remember him vividly. I was 8 when he passed away. But he was very generous, and he would host these wonderful parties. My sister, May, who has a wonderful voice, and she's 90. She might be 91. I think she's about to be 91 any day now. Anyway, she would sing, and then they would get me out of bed, because I'd be... It was a tiny flat that we were in when I think about it. There were 2 bedrooms. My sisters, 3 of them slept in 1 bedroom. My dad and mum slept in the other, what we called the wee bedroom. And my brother and I slept in the kitchen alcove with a cross at one end, and I used to play priests and bounce down the bed and do fake masses and stuff like that, which was one of my fantasies. And... Luckily, I never carried through on that particular fantasy. So it was very tight, but at New Year, we'd be packed. And then I'd be brought on at 1 o'clock, and I'd be just in my pyjamas, and I'd come out bleary-eyed, and then I would do Jolson impersonations. Al Jolson.
So the budding actor was there from an early
age. Oh, right from the start, from the start. But it was the effect. The thing that got me was the effect on the room, and it's what I'll never forget. It's a bit like church, it's a bit like any gathering together when there's a focus and what it does to human beings and how human beings work within that, how they can come together in a sort of harmony. And it was that harmony of the evening. There was a lot of ribaldry, and being Scotland, there's quite a bit of drink taken. But there was this sense of community and sense of being together. And I just thought, that's the great thing. And that's the thing, of course, I love about the theatre. You know, we're all a bunch of strangers, but there's our focus. And somehow there's a sort of thing that happens to human beings in that situation. And it's one of those mysteries that we've slightly ignored, that we haven't looked into. Why do people, when they come together... Of course, you can get the opposite, you know, all kinds of mayhem. But in that kind of setting... There is this harmony.
And of course, there was an element of tragedy as well for you when you were only 8, because your father died of pancreatic cancer. And all of that feeds in to the human experience.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's fascinating about that, because when I was a boy, you know, I lost my father. And then I virtually lost my mother for many, many years, because she had a series of nervous breakdowns. And she felt very guilty. There was a lot of needless guilt that was going on, really. You know, she was the one keeping the family together. And she was very proud. You know, she was an amazing mother. And my 2 elder sisters, who are 16 and 17 years older than me, they were always beautifully turned out. They were like the little princesses. But she had kept the family together. But my dad was... always giving to people, giving people credit. And because he died within 3 weeks of his diagnosis, he'd really pushed the limit out. He made quite a bit of money during the war because he had a received occupation. And he'd given quite a bit of money to businesses to start up to the detriment of... And my mother's great phrase was, charity begins at home. And, of course, I've always been caught between these 2 extremes, you know. But the interesting thing that everybody says about me, it must have been awful for me, but it wasn't, you know, it really wasn't. And it would be a lie for me to say, oh, I was in a state of tragedy all the time. It wasn't. You just adjust. And I think this is the other thing that we don't understand, is our capacity for adjustment. I mean, I was fine. I really was fine. And I did have these sisters who had their own families. It was a great community.
I've noticed that a lot of the music you've chosen actually became very familiar to a wider audience through film.
Yeah.
And in fact, I don't know if this is the connection, but the next piece, the Adagietto from the Mahler Fifth Symphony, was very effective in Death in Venice.
Yeah.
Was that where you encountered it?
No, I encountered it through my wife, funny enough. She played Alma Mahler in a big production where you go into different rooms and there were five Almas, and it was a fascinating, written by Joshua Sobel. And that's where I came across the Mahler. And I thought, wow, this is something, you know.
It goes straight to the heart.
It does indeed.
Part of the Adagietto from Mahler's Symphony No. 5, performed live by the Berliner Philharmonica, conducted by Claudio Abbado. When you got your first job at the Dundee Repertory Theatre, what kind of things did they get you to do, Brian Cox?
Well, my job was the assistant to the assistant. I wasn't even allowed backstage, and there may have been very good reasons for that. I did go backstage eventually, and I think I was probably singularly the worst stage manager that ever walked on two legs. I was terrible. I mean, things like used to happen that I'd be prompting and I'd have the book in front of me and I'd be on page 12. And meanwhile, the rest of the cast were on page 23. So I'd be sitting there daydreaming, kind of looking around. And there's a tap on my shoulder and I go, oh, yes? And it's one of the actress. And she says, telephone. I said, for me? She said, no, on stage. And I forgot to ring the telephone. So then that's what I went, oh, bring. So that was the thing. But before that, I always thought it was odd that they trusted a 15-year-old boy with the night's takings from the theatre to take to the British Linen and Back in Dundee's High Street, because I could have scarpered, you know. But I, of course, that was not within reason. And then at 6 o'clock, my duty was to wash the stage and I could go home.
And how did you actually get to deliver?
To do the acting? Mm. Well, I think I did quite a bit of acting at Dundee, actually, playing small parts, because they were always doing reasonably big casts. So I started to play parts, and then they could see that I could do it. So they were very encouraging to me. And I worked with three directors. The first one was Anthony Page. Of course, he went on to direct Inadmissible Evidence. And then Piers Haggard, who sadly left us last year, who was wonderful. And then the last one was a guy called Bill Davis, a Canadian guy, who is the smoking man in The X-Files. But he's a very fine director. And Bill, one day, he said, listen, I've got this young woman coming up. She's going to do a voice class. Would you like to come? And I had no idea what a voice class was. And, of course, I was up for it. I said, oh, yeah, I'll come, sure. And then I went to this voice class with this extraordinary woman called Christine Linklater. And she was amazing. And I thought, I want to be taught by her. I want to go to where this woman is. So I went to the Lambda. I did an audition. I got in.
You had to change course, didn't you? Because the theatre burnt down.
Oh, yeah, the theatre burnt down on my birthday. June 1st, 1963. It was my 17th birthday. That was a sad moment for me because, as I said, my mother wasn't very well, so I didn't have much of a domestic life. So I used to actually, occasionally, I would sleep in the theatre. I would sleep under the stage, you know, and not go home. And my mother was none the wiser because she was in her own world. So it was kind of my home, you know. So when it burnt down, I ran to the theatre because I heard about the fire and tried to get in, but of course they wouldn't let me in.
But when you got to London, there were all sorts of fascinating people, Peter Brook, Glenda Jackson, Maggie Smith. It was quite an interesting time to be in the theatre.
Yeah, well, London in the 60s. The more important thing about it was the social mobility, that you could come from any class and you were welcomed. I was welcome. I had a full grant. I mean, this is what annoys me about now, where we say, oh, we can't afford to do this, we can't afford to do that. I don't think we were all that well off, but they covered us all. You know, the Scottish Education Authority gave me a full grant. I had my expenses paid, I had the living expenses paid, and my fees paid. And it was amazing. You know, I didn't have that worry. I could focus on what I had to do, which was
so. Is it much more difficult for young actors now?
Oh, it's impossible. It's terrible, particularly from actors of working class backgrounds, because there is no pathway anymore that was there when I was a boy. You know, I was encouraged to make moves in a way.
Well, your next choice, Brian Cox, is Puccini, and it's Madame Butterfly. Was there any special significance to this aria?
Callous.
A great actor as well as a great singer.
The greatest. I think she's astonishing. I mean, sometimes people say, oh, she was a better actor than a singer. Nonsense. I've chosen Madame Butterfly because it's a great aria, but it also shows her at the peak of who she was.
and Bel di Vedremo by Puccini from Madame Butterfly, performed there by Maria Callas with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Tullio Serafin. Do you think you need, Brian, singers who can act like that to really make opera work? Because for a lot of people, it's the drama isn't very real.
Well, it's become realer. I mean, I think there was a time when it was just a lot of singing heads. But I think when you've got really fine directors like Jonathan Miller and Nick Heitner, you know, I'm just very impressed by how opera has really developed into much more of a dramatic art, really. So it's got better and better and better. But she, Callas, was a pioneer. She shook everybody because nobody expected that kind of level of acting. And she really understood what the characters were. I would have loved to see her play some of those Greek heroines. I think she might have been quite extraordinary.
Medea or something.
Medea, exactly.
She was extraordinary in Tosca too, with Tito Gobbi. Yeah. There you had two great actors.
Yeah, yeah. Gobbi was another one.
Now, although you wouldn't put yourself on the same stage as Tito Gobbi, you have sung quite a bit, haven't you?
I have. I mean, it's a family tradition. I love singing. I love it, you know. And it was so part of our tradition growing up, singing to one another, and we just didn't think about it.
You said that it was on stage that you really found your bliss. A nice expression. What do you think it is about the theatre that allows you to express yourself?
Well, I mean, my view is that we are transmitters. There is a sort of energy. It's always difficult to really know where it comes from. It's a mystery. But it's like, it's something which is so primal in terms of what we do by performance. Hamlet says it, really. I mean, Shakespeare says it, holding the mirror up to nature, which is exactly what you have to do. You have to reflect life as it is. And that's why, you know, I'm a humanist, because I think we don't give ourselves enough of a break as humans. You know, we have so many belief systems, which sometimes in the end become confusing, because they actually take you away from who you really are. And who you really are is what goes on inside you and what the imagination does. And I did a video with a child many, many years ago. He's now 16, but he was 2.5. And in the video, you can get it on YouTube, it's called Brian Cox's Masterclass with Theo. And basically all I do is I teach him to be and not to be. And he gets distracted. He does everything that a little boy of two does. And I'm very quiet. I keep gently pulling him back to what we're doing. And it's extraordinary to see a two-year-old boy who, when he comes to the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, makes this gesture where he does this thing with his arms. He sort of tussles a bit. And I just thought, where did that come from? He did that. I didn't do that. That was him. So we underestimate the power of imagination. We really do underestimate. And it's something which is constant, because we're constantly imagining scenarios. And also, I find that everybody's an actor. You know, you're playing a guy interviewing me now, and our producer is playing a producer holding up the mics to interview me. So there is an element of acting in us all, and it's just tapping into that.
And do you think, as with music, having, which I really feel about your acting, having the confidence to leave space between words. I mean, space is such a wonderful commodity.
Put, if I may say so. Space is everything. A fellow actor described it to me wonderfully, that you cut the air in such a way that you give yourself space, and therefore that operates throughout the performance. And the more risk you can take in that, the more it can come off. And sometimes it can go the opposite way. And that's the other thing. You've got to watch indulgence. Don't get too clever. Don't get too smart about your, oh, I can do that now. Because once you've done that, it becomes attitudinizing and it stops being organic.
Your 1984 Olivier Award was for a play called Rat in the Skull, about an interrogation of a suspect IRA bomber. And you played the detective, Nelson, who was described by the New York Times as a violent, battering ram of a man, but also intelligent, self-aware, and tragic. Well, that's an interesting balance, and it sums up very much what you've been talking about, I think.
It's the human story, how we deal with things, and Nelson's reached a point now where it can't go on. Bang on the head for bang on the head, you know, the rat in the skull. I always thought that was a bit much, that title. I thought, oh, rat in the skull, but actually it is a rat in the skull, and especially in the polarity between Protestant and Catholic and all those needless things that have been haunting the Irish and, to a certain extent, a bit to the Scots.
You mentioned Shakespeare just now, and it seems to me that the equivalent in music might be Mozart.
Yeah.
In his ability to portray so many human emotions, but foibles too.
Yeah, and I remember I really got into Mozart having seen Amadeus. Of course, Amadeus is slightly biased. I mean, I think Salieri has made this, like, jealous guy, but actually, it turns out, apparently, they were rather good friends. That was a sort of dramatic creation, and there wasn't this animosity between them. In fact, Salieri was very encouraging of Mozart, because I think that's what music does. I mean, I'm not a musician, and one of my great tragedies is I can't play anything. I'm playing Bach, and it's all fake. You know, I can't, and I'm having to learn how to finger the harpsichord, and it's been quite a journey now. But I do think music has that way of calming the soul and focusing the soul in a very, very lyrical and particular way.
Well, lyrical and very moving,
yeah.
Certainly sums up the slow movement of the piano concerto number 21.
Well, I mean, Arthur Rubinstein, I mean, just think his version of that is just amazing. I mean, it's just an astonishing version. I think it was the first version I heard, and then I went on to hear other people, and they're all right, but there's something about Rubinstein's playing where he just hits the center of it.
Thank you.
The Andante from the Piano Concerto No. 21 in C major by Mozart. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the actor Brian Cox. We have to talk about the TV series Succession, which I binged, actually. I missed it to start off with. Did you have any idea when you first read it that it could be this good?
Well, you're very lucky if you get a script. It was a pitch, of course. And I remember thinking at the time that there is a tradition. Those type of TV shows work very well because in the wake of Dallas and Dynasty, they love those family dramas. And, of course, this is the family drama to end all family dramas because they are extraordinary and extreme. And because they're dealing with a particular people at a particular level of society where they're so entitled and so horrific. And I just thought, this is going to work.
Putting the Rabbit in the Hat is your autobiography, yeah. And it's fascinating. I really enjoyed it. And lots of things come out about it, one of which is, of course, improvisation, which I think there was a lot of in Succession.
There was a bit, yeah. I didn't do it. I decided that Logan was very spare and also extremely bad-tempered, but mainly spare, observing, watching how he plays the room without actually speaking. We kind of use the improvising as like the bread of a sandwich, so that the main meat is the scene, and we could do improvising on either side of it. But on the whole, what you get is the meat, not the bread.
It's been rather fascinating to observe, and indeed, as we're talking now, it's happening, Murdoch handing over his dynasty to his son. Does that strike you as being rather resonant in terms of...
Well, I mean, he's obviously saw the show, and he decided that's the way to go. he's completely followed the path of the show, except Logan is much smarter. I mean, he died, but he actually got what he was already intending to have. So it's quite good that we've sort of outsmarted the Murdochs in some way.
Mendelssohn next, and the Violin Concerto. Mm-hmm. What made you home in on this?
I'm not very good at rationalising why I like this or why I like that, but I just always remembered the opening, you know, when the violin comes in the Mendelssohn. And I just thought, wow, this is so great. And also linking to Bach, you know, he disappeared for a long time. And it was Mendelssohn who was responsible for his revival. So there's a very strong homage element to Bach by Mendelssohn.
Thank you. part of Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto No. 2 in E minor, the Allegro Molto Appassionato, performed by Itzhak Perlman and the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra, conducted by Bernard Haitink. Brian Cox, your latest role is playing Bach in a play called The Score. Tell us a little bit about what it's portraying.
Well, it's interesting because we never see Bach in relationship to the obstacles that he had clearly in his life. And one of the obstacles was Frederick the Great. And Frederick the Great was a warmonger. And it's ostensibly about Bach's relationship to Frederick the Great. But it also has very, very unique reverberations about what's happening in the Ukraine and Russia at the moment. It's interesting about Frederick because Frederick was brutalized by his father. His father used to beat him up on the parade ground in front. I mean, he was a terrible man, Frederick Wilhelm, the father. And Frederick was very sensitive. He was gay and he was an atheist and he was also a flautist. He wanted Bach to be one of his composers. And of course, it meant money for Bach. It was a practical thing. And he's in two minds whether to go and see Frederick. But finally he goes.
And your wife's in it too.
Yeah, yeah. My wife plays Anna Magdalena. And it's written by a very good friend of mine, Oliver Cotton. Now, Oliver is actually the guy who gave me the title for the book, Putting the Rabbit in the Hat, because he was the one who, one day when we were rehearsing, and Albert Finney said, lads, it's like taking a rabbit out of a hat. You know, you just put your hat and you take the rabbit. And Oliver very rightly said, so how do we get the rabbit into the hat? You know, which is really what it's about. So Oliver and his knowledge of Bach is second to none. And his passion for Bach is second. In fact, he's really the one who's led me into the whole Bach thing, you know. And of course there's so much music by Bach. I mean, so much. The irony is I've played Bach before. I played him in a television thing, must have been over 20 years ago, even if not longer. And I didn't get it. I didn't get him because there was something kind of dry that I couldn't get who the man was. What Oliver has done is he's really created the man. So it's fun because he's a worker. He has this great line when he says, I've worked too hard and too long. And, you know, he was running four churches at one time.
And
he
was turning out pieces for every feast day.
Absolutely. Well, he had to have a new cantata every Sunday. So if you imagine that, that was 52 cantatas a year. You know, I mean, it was incredible. And they expected the burghers of Leipzig were, they were awful people. They really, and he was fighting that all the time because he loved his music. That was his thing. And of course, there's the technical side of Bach, but then there are pieces like Bach's Chaconne, which I particularly find incredibly moving. And that was also introduced to me by Oliver, because he's a classical guitarist, and he played it on the guitar, which was the first time I heard the Chaconne. And I went, what is that? And he said, well, it's actually Bach. I said, that's Bach? Bach is always regarded as not being emotional, and actually when you get dig down to it, he is highly emotional.
Well, after that, we can only hear the Chaconne, and what a beautiful piece it is too.
Oh, I love it. It's just, it's so moving. Thank you.
The first part of the violin partita number 2 in D minor, the Chaconne by Johann Sebastian Bach, played by Hilary Hahn, who I think you particularly wanted to hear.
Yes, she's amazing. She's just simply amazing.
In the TV series Deadwood, Brian Cox, released in 2004, you played the director of a theatre group determined to bring culture to a violent frontier mining town. He was a man, like you, genuinely in love with the theatre.
Oh, Jack Langrish, he was a true person. He really existed. He was Irish extraction. He ran a theatre in Chicago, and he met the Great Fire of Chicago, where he lost everything. And then eventually he ended up in Deadwood. And they did, and I find this extraordinary, and we were going to do it when there was a row in the series. David took the series away and just said, oh, I'm not going to do it anymore, which was left us, a lot of us, very sad. But in that, I think it would have been the fourth series, Langrish, he directs a production, and it's the American premiere of The Mikado, which was done in Deadwood. So in the town, there was a lot of Chinese characters. So we had this fantasy that all the extras on the opera would be all these Chinese characters that he had. I wanted to do it. I was looking forward, because he also played Nanki Poo, which was...
When I was in school, I was Pooh Bah, the Lord High Everything Else. Do we still need theatre in a modern world? What can it do for us, do you think, in society? Why do you still so love it?
I have to be careful what I say about this, but it's something I really believe, because it's the one unadorned church. It isn't tied into Judaism or Islamism or Catholicism or Protestantism. It's free of all that. It's about who we are as human beings dealing with all those things like Judaism, Protestantism, you know, Islamism and Catholicism. So that's what I love about the theatre, is it's the true projection of who we are and what we're beset by and the things that drive us and the things that stop us and the things that encourage us and the things that make certain stuff possible. That's why I believe in the theatre.
And unlike film, it can evolve every evening, can't it?
Yeah, it can. But film also does the same thing. I mean, you have a couple of runs at something and then you get it. And I wouldn't knock film because it was my initial passion, because film was classless. So it was the thing that everybody went to. Theatre was always still a little bit... I remember we used to describe the ladies who went to the theatre in Dundee. And it's not my word, but they used to call them the Felties, because they all wore felt hats. You know, they were all very beautifully turned out, going, we're off to the theatre. Oh, that's great. What are you saying? Oh, it's a sort of Brian Rix comedy, but I'm looking forward to it, you know. So the theatre was quite middle class. It's a very different experience from the cinema.
Your journey has been extraordinarily various, and I can't help wondering, finally, whether there are things that have eluded you, whether there are roles you would still love to do.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I still think I'm the lost Hamlet of all times, you know. But I don't dwell on it, because you have to keep moving.
Joni Mitchell, you've chosen as your final piece.
Yeah, she's just incredible. Again, like Callas with The Voice, and her range and her writing. And Blue, the album Blue, is one of the finest albums I think there is. But this song, A Case of You, is just a beautiful song, and she does it so astonishingly well.
Brian Cox, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Just before our love got lost, you said, I am as constant as a northern star. And I said, constantly in the darkness, where's that at? If you want me, I'll be in the bar, on the back of a cartoon coaster, in the blue TV screen light. I drew a map of Canada, oh Canada, with your face sketched on it twice. I would still be on my feet. box of paints. I'm frightened by the devil, and I'm drawn to those ones that ain't afraid. I remember that time you told me, you said love is touching souls. Surely you touch my anchor, part of you pours out of me.
Case of You from Joni Mitchell's 1971 album Blue. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the actor Brian Cox. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, to celebrate Black History Month, Michael will be hosting a selection of inspiring guests from recent editions of the programme who chose music written or performed by black women. That's next Sunday at the regular time, 12 noon. This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio, on BBC Sounds and on most smart speakers. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the latest news, read by me, John Shea. The director of a hospital in southern Gaza has told the BBC he is expecting it to run out of power completely tomorrow. The Nasser Hospital is treating 4,000 patients, but it's also now trying to meet the health needs of hundreds of thousands of civilians who fled northern Gaza. They've been told to leave ahead of a huge military offensive, which is expected to combine air, sea and land operations. The bombing of the Gaza Strip has continued, with Israeli fighter planes and drones striking targets in the territory. President Biden has spoken by telephone to both the Israeli Prime Minister and the leader of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Mr. Biden said Washington was working with the United Nations and governments in the Middle East to ensure that civilians in Gaza had access to food, water and medicine. A missile fired into Israel from Lebanon has killed one person. Three people were wounded. The militant group Hezbollah said it had fired a missile which hit a village near the border between the two countries. The Israeli military says it's retaliating by striking targets in southern Lebanon. Vladimir Putin has said Russian troops are making gains during an offensive against Ukrainian positions. There's been particularly intense fighting around the city of Avdiivka, where the authorities say two more civilians were killed by Russian shelling overnight. Ukraine insists its troops are managing to hold ground. There's been another strong earthquake in western Afghanistan, days after two powerful tremors killed more than 1,300 people. It struck northwest of the city of Herat with a magnitude of 6.3. The Scottish National Party are attempting to map out a route to independence at their annual conference. Members will debate a plan to use the results of the next general election in Scotland to push for talks with Westminster. The American actress Piper Laurie, who was nominated for 3 Oscars, has died. She was 91. In a career spanning several decades, she was best known for playing the deranged mother in the horror film Carrie. And the weather. A largely dry day with plenty of sunshine, but there will be some patchy cloud around coastal areas. There'll be showers across northern Scotland, where it will also be breezy. And that's the news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:02.
African classical music on BBC Radio 3.
My name is Tunde Jegede. I'm a musician and composer. 2 instruments are at the heart of my life as an artist: the cello and the kora. And in this 3-part series, I'll be celebrating music from across the continent of Africa, sharing pieces that I believe can be defined as classical.